I thought we would go first talking about what happened this month to Adrian Moore. The Reason Foundation has been based in California since 1971, or the precursor to the Reason Foundation has been, and part of our portfolio, specifically on the research side, has been to engage on California issues and propositions and to engage with the Schwarzenegger administration. From the beginning, Reason put together a fantastic sort of a California performance review with a variety of suggestions of how the incoming post-recall governor might be able to sort of reshape California, limit the size of government. And I think he looked at it and sneezed and then has grown the size of the California budget by $45 billion since then. Adrian Moore has been working on this. And Adrian, give us a sense of what happened in California on statewide issues.
California politics has long been an interesting aberration in a lot of ways, and in some ways not an aberration. The election, there was a lot of strange things that happened in this election, particularly in the context that California faces. We've argued for some time that one of Reason's roles, since we were born and raised in California and we're still headquartered here, is being the libertarian conscience of California and creating that expectation that when there's a hot political or policy debate in California that Reason can provide the appropriate libertarian perspective and analysis on that. So we did analysis of all the ballot initiatives that were on. There were 12 ballot initiatives, and they covered a pretty broad range of topics. And then there was the broader fiscal politics. California's budget's been going downhill ever since the Terminator became governor in a pretty amazing ways. He's rolled out bold initiative after bold initiative and has exceeded exactly this much success. He hasn't done a darn thing since he became governor, except talk. And talk while the budget grows. So we're supposed to have a budget in June, and we haven't often met that goal. It's usually been late. This year was a record setter. We didn't get the budget till September. And they passed a balanced budget in September, and within 4 weeks, it was $7 billion upside down. And $7 billion is more than the total budget of a fair number of states in this nation. And it's got worse. As the economy declines, the revenues that government collects from all of us decline as well, and that harsh reality is never really recognized in advance. So this budget took none of that into account in September, remember. None of them could foresee that revenue might decline in September. All the rest of us were busy cutting luxuries right and left in September, and the state budget is, and this is not just California, it's other states. Yeah, they were a rosy scenario all the way. Well, it only took weeks for that reality to come home to roost. So we go into this election, traditionally and historically in California, when the economy has declined, Californians have been very tough on spending measures that they actually get to vote on, like bonds on the ballot. They have about half the rate of passage during hard economic times that they do during good times. But not this time. All the bonds passed. Everyone voted to borrow against lower future revenues next year and the year after to pay for things this year, like that's going to work. And that was consistent with their vote in the presidential election in many ways, as was their vote on a lot. There were a number of social issues on the ballot that were not consistent with that. It was quite odd. We had a measure that would allow some drug treatment options for nonviolent drug offenders that didn't pass. We had a measure that would allow gay marriage that didn't pass. So you had some sort of conservative direction votes. At the same time, you had some very liberal directions votes. But the oddest outcome of the election by far is there were two large alternative energy measures on the ballot that went down and went down big after being extraordinarily popular before the election. So somehow, the psyche of California torqued in some very odd ways in this election that I don't think people have really figured out exactly what's going on there. And one of the things I'm curious about, I know Matt will probably bring this up later, is, you know, energy policy is going to be a big deal in the coming couple of years. And the way people voted in this election on energy-specific issues was counterintuitive. Most of the alternative energy measures around the country that were out there went down. And what does that reflect? Is that part of just the pocketbook voting, or is there some other repercussion that we don't yet fully understand? I don't know. But when the next federal energy package rolls out, we might learn a little more about that. So California faces some very, very interesting times. We have to close a gigantic budget deficit that's growing rapidly. And first response, as it is almost universally in this country by government when revenues decline, is we have to cut everything by 5%. You know, which is the most insane way to react to a budget crisis. Second most insane way. The most insane way, I guess, would be, oh, well, let's double spending. But the second most insane way is to cut everything by 5%, you know, which is the equivalent of, you know, cutting your going out to movie budget just as much as you cut your mortgage payment at home. It's just an insane way. There's the utter lack of willingness to even think about or introduce the concept of prioritization is just stunning. And then the second order reaction is we've got to have more revenue because we can't cut your way out of a problem, so we're going to have to raise taxes. And I think something on the order of about a dozen different fee, tax, just plain find some way to get your money ideas have floated out there, and the ways to tax Californians idea mill is churning rapidly. It's not popular. even among fairly statist folks in California, any kind of increase in taxes or fees is going to be unpopular. So I think we're going to have interesting times in the next 6 months in California as we figure out how to adjust these movements among the people and these realities that we face that are pushing and pulling in different directions.
Two quick follow-ups. Has Schwarzenegger in any of this process engaged in any kind of interesting idea about how to reduce government in order to fill the shortfall? That's the first question.
Yeah, define engage. you mentioned, you know, starting from when he first came into office, he's been rhetorically and even sort of in an internal staff sense pushing, you know, pushing the development of interesting ideas. He has zero willingness to invest any political capital in them. So people, he has some smart people that work for him, and they generate interesting ideas.
And he is himself smart, I think.
And he's a smart guy. He'll look at an idea, and he'll have interesting and innovative reactions to him. But just the translation of that into action is stymied both by, I think, he has just weird political implementation instincts, and he surrounded himself with the most, his implementation people, as opposed to his idea people, are the most hidebound, status quo, just useless people you can imagine. They are the antithesis of change, and that's what he put in his implementation team. So nothing has changed.
And is he? Do you foresee him going to Washington, as I believe the New York governor already has done, and rattle the tin cup and say, "Hey, look, you know, you got to bail out the states if you're going to bail out, you know."
Oh, no. Actually, Arnie went to Washington before the New York governor. He was the first one to write a letter to the federal government saying, "We think we at the time he wrote it in mid October, he was thinking we might be $7 billion upside down." And so he said, I'm thinking we might need a bailout for California. That number's grown. And now if you look at what it's the sort of the one-liner about the next stimulus package that is particularly coming out of the Obama camp and sometimes out of Congress, the list now is public works spending and state aid are two of the three sort of specifics in there. Public works funding is money for city governments, and state aid is money for state budgets. So the The idea out there now among state and local governments is that we're going to get the federal government to pass a stimulus package that's going to backfill our budget shortfalls, at least for this first year. Thank God.
Did Michael Lisi set another thing on fire?
Yeah. But two of the most... two of the most interesting fiscal pressures out there that most people don't think about is that the stimulus package is going to be a big debt...
Just keep going.
Just talk.
Yeah, okay. A big, I don't know if you guys, a big stimulus, it's a big deficit spending stimulus package essentially to pump up state and local government spending at the same time the federal government is borrowing in order to do that. And then as the market has crashed, one of the biggest growing items in state and local government budgets for a number of years now has been pension and health care obligations for government employees. It's these very large future obligations that are unfunded, and there's this idea that if we just keep putting a little bit away each year into the stock market, that money will keep growing and somehow we'll line things up eventually, even though kind of like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, the numbers don't add up. When the stock market tanked in this fall, those savings plans tanked as well, and to the tune of almost $1 trillion across all state and local governments. California alone took essentially a $70 billion new debt on because of the loss of the pension fund value in that. And so, these fiscal pressures are just kind of stunning.
Well, that's very cheerful. If there's anyone who can talk over an alarm going over the PA system, it's Andrew Breitbart.
Good luck with the transition from what he has to say.
I thought I was doing good. Andrew, for those of you who don't know him, is a great new media pioneer and also a commentator on all mores Hollywood. He's a co-author 4 years ago of a great and funny book called Hollywood Interrupted. He has a new column that's debuting for the Washington Times called Big Hollywood and a website to go with it that hopefully he'll talk about. He has had a long-time association with the Drudge Report, and that's all I'm allowed to say about that. And he's a key figure in sort of the underground of Hollywood, of people who don't necessarily... sign on to the orthodoxy that sort of dominates the political discourse part of Hollywood. Andrew, what has the election looked like and the Obama universe that we now live in look like from your vantage point, both for the people that you love to mock and the people that you like to hang out with?
Well, after writing that book in 2004, I got a phone call from my old boss. I was her researcher, Arianna Huffington, and she said...
This is back in the days when she was...
But no, it was this time after the election in 2004, she called me up and said, would you create a website for me? I said, let me think about it. Why don't we take your Rolodex, your titanium Rolodex, and put it online and get people, all your really fancy friends, to write for free? I can't stand the left. I mean, she knows that about me. And anyway, we started the Huffington Post, and I thought it'll be great because my friends on the right will be able to hear how crazy the conspiracy theories that come from Ariana's little salons are. I think I got Obama elected. So I feel mild guilt to see how this thing has sort of succeeded. I left it after I launched it because I realized there was no natural home for me. At the Huffington Post, I tried to hang out with them. I tried to say, "Hey, let's go to a Moby concert. Let's find some common ground." It wasn't going to happen, so I left. I still can't stand the Hollywood left, but I just thought, well, I choose to live in West Los Angeles. That's my fault. Why don't I move to Topeka, Kansas, if I want to be around people that agree with me? Within the last 2 years, circumstances have led me to an incredible discovery that I think that the world needs to find out about, and this is why I'm endeavoring into creating a blog of a similar sort of architecture as the Huffington Post. It's going to be called Big Hollywood. It's called Big Hollywood because anything that the left can't stand, any sector of the economy the left can't handle or isn't getting a sufficient amount of funding from, they just put big in front of it. Big pharma, big oil. I'm like, well, Hollywood's got like a disparity of income, you know, making $20 million a movie. And I remember making $225 a week being a PA. So it's a corrupt business. So I thought, why not call it Big Hollywood? So I've started this column where I'm trying to write. It started off writing a column starting this summer to Washington to explain to them that they've writ, at least the conservative movement that I consider myself a part of, and I'm kind of a lowercase L libertarian. But what I've discovered over the last few years is that there are a ton of people in Hollywood who consider themselves either conservatives or libertarian who, because of a certain totalitarian environment in this town, that if you disagree with Ariana and her bloggers, you're not going to be invited to the correct parties. If you're on sets, and I know this from the actors and the directors and the writers that I've come to know over the last few years, you can say that it's, you know, not a blacklist, and they'll say it's not a blacklist, but if you effectively think that your career is going to you know, be stifled or hurt in any way, you're going to keep quiet about your politics. And so the left completely prevails in Hollywood the same way the left completely prevails anywhere else that it has a majority control. Like, I would say that the best analogy I would say is the college campus. And I can tell you that there are thousands of conservatives in Hollywood and thousands of libertarians, and they desperately want to figure out a way, especially in this election cycle. They wanted to come out and say, if all the Hollywood people can go on the Huffington Post and, you know, write about their belief system, why can't we? Why are we worried that if we donate to McCain, why are we worried that we're going to be outed in Defamer or Gawker or Perez Hilton? I mean, it's getting to the point now, specifically with the Prop 8 thing, and this is just a window into the mindset of what these people have to experience. I don't care what you think about the Prop 8 situation, is those people who have donated to Prop 8, to Yes on Prop 8, are now being exposed in Gawker, Defamer, Perez Hilton, and they're being protested. Well, that is specifically what happens to people who donate to people who have an R next to their name in Hollywood. And I get phone calls from very prominent people saying, oh my God, I had no idea I donated $500 to this candidate. How do I erase this from my record? If the studios find out about this, I'm screwed. If Gawker, Defamer, if they write about it. So the New York Times will scour, or Politico, my friend Jeff Reznor, he does that. He's a writer for Politico, and he covers the Hollywood scene. He just goes through the list of people who are donating to people, because it's all on the public record. And then he just nonchalantly references, oh, these are the 20 actors who donated to the Republican Party. Well, to a person, all of those Republican donors who are in Hollywood are fearful of their career. Yesterday, a friend of mine who's an actor, he had a movie launched yesterday, and it described him in his movie, and he was the director, the writer, and an actor in it. The first description of him in the movie review in the New York Times was McCain shill, okay? And it, of course, they panned it. This person sees a correlation between the pan, and then I started to look up the reviews of this, the previous reviews from this reviewer, and this is a guy who just was jumping up on up and down on his bed, his little twin bed, little freak, you know, over every single Michael Moore movie. I'm like, you do not have this guy. This guy's one of the more out, you know, conservatives in Hollywood. There is 100% retribution. That's what I'm trying to create here, is that if Ariana can have her Huffington Post, and I'm such a free speech advocate that I feel very comfortable having created that, even though I don't agree with it. I think that there should be an environment for debate in this town, and to send a message not just to the rest of America and Washington, but to the rest of the world, that our pop culture isn't so monolithic. And I think that if we, to tie this back to the election, it was pretty much a 99.9% pro-Obama Hollywood that was represented in this election cycle. And if you compare it to the last election cycles with Kerry and Gore, here there's a huge difference, and I think this is why it was a winning one for Barack Obama. In 2004 and in 2000, you have two imperfect candidates that people less liked than, it wasn't that they didn't really like Gore and they really didn't like Kerry. They had to get behind him the way that conservatives got behind McCain. Okay, fine, we'll vote for him, but we'll do it, you know, holding our noses. The celebrities during that period of time spent most of their time attacking the Republican Party and attacking George Bush. The average American was thinking, you know what, I'm sick of hearing celebrities telling me what to think. I hate it when they do it, and I hate when they viciously attack the president. I hate when they viciously attack conservatives. There is a difference from celebrities saying they can't stand Coca-Cola versus a celebrity saying, man, I just took a sip of this Pepsi. It's the greatest thing in the world. And I think that the success of Barack Obama was the unanimity of voice of the celebrity crowd that helped his marketing to say, wow, this guy's a new flavor, and we really like this thing. And so it would be my goal, if this we're going to enter into the marketing phase of electoral politics, where you don't know what the person necessarily stands for on policy, but you're going to vote for him because there's something, you know, larger than life and celebrity-like about him. You know, I would like the other side to be able to have the same type of platform to try to attempt this. And I'll end it on this note. I knew the election was over when I saw the Will.i.am video. And I said that. I said Barack Obama is going to win the presidency if you were to give conservatives $1 billion to try and create the same vibe. You would get Hummel figurines, the movie. So there you go.
I'm going to talk just a little bit about the view from my unreal or hyper-real perch in Washington, D.C., where I moved a year ago. Probably the first thing that really struck me from being there was the absolute exhaustion emanating from most organizations on the right that are tied to Republicans and libertarian organizations as well. Mike Flynn, who will be talking later here, has been involved in Washington in a lot of these groups. And whether it's just like going to someone's annual dinner, the attendance is down 25%, or just talking to people who have been involved in activist groups or whatever, there is absolute fatigue in the Republican coalition and in Washington, which is, I think, a great artifact after 8 years of sort of a semi-coherent kind of big government conservatism, where basically everyone at some point, however you came to Republicanism, were outraged by some aspect of the way that Bush governed. And what we're seeing right now is it's going to be interesting, because the most hardcore Republican groups are fighting a civil war to try to figure out who to blame for this and which horse to back and which approach to take. And that's, I think, going to dominate discourse, certainly on magazines like National Review and the Weekly Standard, and among a lot of these groups. Sarah Palin, just the most strangely divisive human being ever. I first noted this in St. Paul, where I was at the Republican convention, and heard her speech, which I thought was pretty great. It was just kind of fun, and I think she's an interesting character, if nothing else, of the kind that we don't normally see in national politics. And I went across the street afterwards to a bar and talked to someone, a Democrat, who was like, "Oh my God, did you see that speech? That was the worst thing I have ever seen in my life. I fear for my country." And I felt like, really, wow, I didn't realize that a hockey mom could be so divisive. Well, it turns out that she's incredibly divisive among Republicans now, too. The whole Civil War is based on her. And there's actually even on the website redstate.org, I think it is, a thing called Operation Leper, which is designed to find out McCain staffers who are now leaking nasty sort of information, or even some kind of lies we're finding out about Sarah Palin. Find out who they are, create a blacklist so that they can never work on a Republican campaign again for the rest of their lives. See? There you go. I'm sure there's other people who are gonna clap for sending Sarah Palin to the gallows. But it's a battle between, is this a social conservative party? Is this a Jeff Flake party? I wish it was a Jeff Flake party. I don't mean political party. I mean, like, you know, dancing and stuff. And there is no one narrative that seems to be winning right now. So I think that Republicans are going to be engaged in this kind of circular firing squad slash how are we going to approach this, you know, in the future, and how we're going to win elections in 2010 and 2012. Meanwhile, there is unified Democratic government who's going to try to push through a few things while people are distracted over there. Reason is in a pretty, I think, an interesting and good position in many respects. I think that the most significant thing that happened this fall was not the election of Barack Hussein Obama. It was the bailout by George Hussein Bush. And we will be living with the implications from that for 4 years, 8 years, 80 years, as we're already seeing now with the bailout, the rescue, as it was rechristened. I bored a lot of you with this already individually, but literally, I think it was in yesterday's business section of the New York Times, three stories above the fold, each one had in the lead a version of the word rescue or rescuing. I don't recall seeing such quick turnaround on absolute sort of propagandistic reframing of an issue. It's incredible. It was a bailout on the day they put it up for the House vote to begin with. When that failed, it became a rescue, and by Friday, it's been a rescue in every single newspaper in the country. It's bizarre. But anyways, at Reason, we are focused like a laser beam on this because you're seeing on the left a lot of people saying, "Oh, this is the laissez-faire capitalism. It's over." This deregulation era of George W. Bush, even though he's increased regulation by 60% in 8 years, we need to repudiate that. You have a lot of writers like Jacob Weisberg from Slate and crazier people like Naomi Klein trying to blame libertarianism for what they've seen in George W. Bush. There's an attempt, basically, to fight capitalism in a way that we haven't seen, I don't think, since the end of the Cold War, the kind of Washington consensus of more or less free markets and democracy is kind of better than not free markets and democracy. That is under direct attack right now. So we are mobilized to fight that, while people who are more invested in the future and past of the Republican Party are busy, you know, fighting each other to the death in the pages of the Weekly Standard and elsewhere. We've been trying to figure out what we're going to get in Obama, a thing that a lot of conservatives are worried about the fairness doctrine. Our managing editor, Jesse Walker, wrote a piece that some of you might have read. I think it was in the November issue. That leads me to believe that Obama's probably not going to touch the fairness doctrine, but kind of more for a variety of reasons, one of which is it's going to be a, you know, a Republican organizing principle in a way that no actual politician could do. But what he's much more likely to do is be involved in sort of insidious mission creep of the FCC into sort of broadcast, getting into cable regulation in a way that they can't. But the thing that I'm most worried about in the sort of first 100 days while Republicans are distracted is card check, which Congressman Flake talked about last night. Obama is a co-sponsor of it. It's big on his website. This is something that we need to do, is to have, you know, secret to abolish secret ballots to organize unions. It's the kind of thing that is so far, for some reason, hasn't really been written about outside of places like Reason and outside of some, you know, like Free Republic probably talks about it and a few other
Mickey
people.
Mickey Kouse.
Mickey Kouse talks about it. But in general, it hasn't been a big media issue. So it could be the kind of thing that they could sneak through early, which is worrying on all kinds of fronts. And you're seeing already with him saying things like, you know, the big three automakers are the backbone of American industry, and that he's going to create 5 million green jobs by waving his finger around. That you're seeing a centralization of kind of industrial policy on a scale that we haven't seen in a long time, and that's going to happen quick. There's a strange phenomenon in Washington of what are called Obamacons, or sort of libertarians for Obama. Now, granted, I did write a book about John McCain. I understand not voting for the Republican. But it's in Washington, there are a lot of libertarians, and there might be some in this room, who will sit with a straight face and say, oh, Obama's going to be great on free trade. And it's baffling to me, because in every single speech that he's ever given, he's not only bashing free trade, talking about rewriting the North American free trade agreement, but he's bashing China very specifically and nastily. And I'll ask people, okay, tell me what it is that makes you think that he's going to be anything that's good on trade. And it's like, well, his one advisor gave that one speech in Canada that one time. I think to underestimate the potency of his kind of charisma and his sort of blank slateness. Andrew and I were talking about this before. People project their hopes and dreams on this guy in a way that we haven't seen, at least since John McCain in 2000, but I think much more than that. They look at him, they see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear, and it was amplified by the fact that if you paid close attention to the debates, he frequently just doesn't say anything. He's on both sides of an issue and doesn't stake out particular turf. So I think a lot of people who have invested a lot of hopes in him are going to be pretty cruelly and quickly disappointed. But again, I think a lot of that also just speaks to the fatigue of Republicanism and the sense that, you know, what does it mean to be Republican anymore? I think very few people have a strong sense of what that definition is. So I've been paying attention more to what he said every single day on the campaign trail, which is 5 million new green jobs. We're going to invest in energy in the same way that we invested in the Silicon Valley, which makes zero sense. It's kind of fascinating. And what he's going to be able to do while Republicans are still busy shooting each other in the face. What time do we have here? This is the political discussion, so I wanted to end earlier rather than later. Can you talk a little bit more about Andrew's sort of I wouldn't say obsessed about media bias, but he's pretty obsessed by media bias. Can you talk a little bit about how you observe that in the process of this election?
Well, I would say I am obsessed with media bias. I know these journalists. I know who they are. It's what I've been doing for the last 15 years, and my gut instinct that there was a liberal media bias, boy, was I wrong. It's way, way worse than I could possibly have imagined. I can pretty much guarantee you that if the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or any traditional media organ were to be handed a dossier with that proved that Barack Obama was, a spy for Venezuela, that they would not report that. First of all, there wouldn't be a Pulitzer Prize for that. The Pulitzer Prize, the Nobel Prize, the Oscars have been so co-opted by the left. I believe that the desire for Hollywood to redeem Al Gore, you know, by giving that PowerPoint presentation an Oscar. I mean, it's just like, it's so laughable. It's like, oh, wow, we got away with that. Let's give him a Nobel Peace Prize. It's gotten really, really, really bad because from about 1995 to about 2005, I would have assessed the internet as a center-right corrective to the left-leaning media. I would say that with the rise of the Daily Kos and the Huffington Post and MoveOn.org, which use less, you know, I would say that the Free Republics and the Drudge Report and all these other entities that tie in with talk radio are information-based, counter-information, which information that's given to people who, as they're driving back and forth to go to work. The left has more of an activist mindset. You know, it's not just about information. It's about now what? Donate money. Go to this protest over here. Intimidate people. Make people realize that we're here and we mean business, whereas I don't think the conservatives or libertarians are as now effective right now as the ascendant counter-media. And when the counter-media is to the left of the traditional media, I think you're in big trouble. And that's where I think we are right now, because I think that the Huffington Post and the Daily Kos of the world are acting as a firewall for the type of stuff that would have hurt you. When Dan Rather got nailed in 2004, that thing was able to just rise above the traditional media, and the traditional media was forced to have to deal with that story. Like, oh, great, you know, these guys again, you know, forcing us to deal with stories that we would traditionally, you know, just ignore. I believe that the one of the mechanisms that the Huffington Post and the Daily Kos does is that it spends all day attacking Think Media Matters, which is part of that organism, fending off those type of stories that would have ordinarily come from talk radio and the libertarian center right media, and so they don't have to defend anymore. And what has also happened is that when you have the Huffington Post and the Daily Kos proudly saying we're far, 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 far left, it helps to make the New York Times look just a little bit to the right of that. And I think that they've acted a little bit more open in recent times, you know, not even ashamed of wearing their politics. And so it seems to me that the left now controls 99% of the media, and they have an argument, except for talk radio, and I'll readily admit that that's very right of center, but it's people saying, I'm a Republican, and this is what I feel about things. But it seems to me that they don't think that the other side should have a voice. They treat my channel 360 on my DirecTV as if it's the most outrageous manifestation of media of all time, that Fox News shouldn't exist, and the language that the John Podestas of the world have towards an alternative point of view is shocking to me. And the very idea that they were talking so openly about a fairness doctrine, you know, whether or not they do it or not, shows the level of contempt that they have for debate in a free society.
Just to pile on a stupid anecdote from the Democratic Convention, we went and saw a panel discussion about sort of race and gender in the 2008 election. It was actually very fascinating. It was, I think, moderated by Dan Abrams from MSNBC, and had like D.D. Myers, Bill Richardson, a bunch of people. And the token right-winger was Tucker Carlson, who's a pretty interesting cat, if any of you guys know him. Tucker made some sort of provocative but interesting comments about what role the ascendancy of Barack Obama might mean for affirmative actions and racial preferences and such. And Marcos Mulugla, whatever his name is, of the Daily of the Daily Coast, who's a fascinating character in many ways, and describes himself as a libertarian Democrat. Although I'm not very convinced by that.
I read that thread. It's the funniest thread of all time.
Oh, like the comments and the...
No. His thesis on why the left is a natural home for libertarianism.
Right.
It's my favorite read on the internet. Look for it.
After Tucker talked, Marcos immediately said, the worst thing that you can have is listening to a Republican give advice to Democrats. And anyways, why is he even on this panel? And then the crowd got into a lather about let's kick Tucker off this panel because he was one person out of 10 who didn't lean towards the Democratic Party. Adrian, I wanted to ask you, Obama says a lot of things, but one thing that he does say is that he is insistent on having his numbers add up, and he actually ran giving nods to a certain kind of fiscal responsibility in a way, which is everyone out of power does, he at least talks about that. Given that he talks about this, and that he also talks about, for instance, huge infrastructure spending, do you perceive any opening to say, hey, look, I know how to have your infrastructure spending give a little bit more bang for your buck? Is there any place within that you see any hope or sign of tangible kind of optimism or wiggle room?
Wiggle room is better than optimism, I think. It's a lot easier to promote transparency and accountability on the other guys than it is on yourself. Now that he would have to live with that, he might not be quite as enthusiastic about it as he was as a senator. One of the interesting questions about, not the first 100 days, but, as his administration matures and faces some pretty big, the transportation bill, which is one of the giant bills that covers many years of a huge chunk of federal spending, is going to initiate in this coming year, a few other things like that. And the fact that he's probably going to do a stimulus package that will add substantially to the deficit, there's the pressure from lots of different directions on him in 09 and in 2010 to acknowledge and respond to that in some sort of meaningful way does create some wiggle room, at least. And I think, he has advocated infrastructure. He may see giving the state and local governments, which do all the infrastructure in the country, really, money, essentially, he can check that campaign obligation off. If he doesn't, if he actually continues sort of some of his rhetoric and that infrastructure is actually the real economic development policy in a lot of ways, then maybe there is some wiggle room for, the ideas of reason and on how to do infrastructure in a much more cost-effective, private capital investment-driven way rather than federal deficit spending way. I think a big dimension of that is going to be, I've been thinking some about, it's just conventional wisdom now that there will be some kind of backlash, maybe even more, that there's going to be a change in the Republican Party. Once they're done shooting themselves in the face, the logical expectation is that the fiscal conservatives and the smaller government folks will wind up being much more active and much more prominent. Talking to Congressman Flake that's not going to start in Congress because the same big government status quo leadership is still in charge and, in fact, has cemented rapidly in the wake of the election their position of control in Congress and marginalized anyone who they think might possibly be sort of for becoming fiscal conservatives again. So Congress is bunkered down. It's the Republican governors and, to a lesser extent, the Republican state legislators out there who are saying, we're gonna take it to a whole new low in the next election unless we come back really strong. So that's where the backlash is going to start, is probably state and local level. Given that the infrastructure package and a lot of this spending, the transportation spending and everything, that's basically federal money that goes to the state and local level. There's going to be a push and pull there that could, you know, open that wiggle room up into actually some sense. I mean, maybe that gives not Republicans in Congress, but Republican governors and just state governments who want to survive financially some leverage with the Obama administration that leads to some fiscally responsible outcomes. I mean, I'm kind of spinning that as optimistically as possible, but I'd say the kernel of truth there, though, is that you know, at the Republican Governors Association, somewhere out there, I think, is Len Gilroy, who's Reason's head of privatization. He was just at the Republican Governors Association, and he said it's overwhelming there how much some of those governors are saying, wow, we've got to get radical. And when you've got a fiscal crisis and a strong political desire to get radical, that's when they do crazy stuff like privatization. And you know, so there's a huge opportunity there for a lot of Reason's ideas to get in, and that's, you know, that at least within certain dimensions of federal policy, that filters right up to Congress.